All right, we're taking up Representative Earhart's bill, and that's House File 198, School District Referendum Allowance Limits, repealed, and I will move House File 198 before committee for possible consideration in the Omnibus Finance Bill. Welcome. I see some familiar faces here. The usual suspects, right?
Yeah.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. The reason I am bringing this bill forth is that I get the local paper from where I have my cabin, which is in the Reamer School District. And I opened the, in November, I opened the front page of the Press Citizen, Pinecone Press Citizen, and it talks about the school district expenditure increasing from $11,803 to $13,500 in 2004. And I thought, wow, my district gets about $8,000. That's about their expenditures, and there ought to be, this ought to maybe be looked into. And so I got a printout. I might add that over at, as the campaign season wound down, I began to get reports. That cartoon there is a example of paid for by the Rural Preservation Pact is the disclaimer on it, and they were had either, this one happens to have Jerry Dempsey's name on it, but there's another one that has Maxine Tennis's name on it, and Finstead had one on him, and so it was being circulated around the state with somebody else's name on it, and always by the rural, paid for by the Rural Preservation Pact. I think that's very unsettling to the setting of good policy, that someone is trying to drive a wedge between rural and metro, and I think it's really uncalled for. So I just wanted to bring it to your attention, because that cartoon is incorrect to begin with, much less the way it's used. So that printout that you have, and I don't know how many you have, but it's the one that's that faces this way on your 8.5 by 11.
Representative Earhart, I'd just like to interrupt you for 1 minute. Members, you can take a look at this cartoon and then just let's pitch that. This isn't, I mean, I agree, this is not correct and it is not fair. It was part of a campaign. What we're about here is trying to make a fair system of funding for everybody. I mean, for all school districts, so that everybody can feel they're fairly funded. And I agree that this divisive kind of campaigning just creates, it creates certain ideas that aren't always true, that lead to divisiveness here at the legislature and to small groups working together against each other instead of all of us working together to come up with the best possible solutions. So I would say throw that away, and I hope we don't have to see this junk, you know, in the future, and I certainly don't wish to see it in committees. And let's go on from here, Representative Earhart.
Thank you. Just to give you an example of how wrong that is, and you can look your own school district up on that printout, the third column over is the expenditures rank by school district.
Which printout are you on, sir?
I'm on the sideways 8.5 by 11.
This one, not the tall, skinny one.
The one that says school district spending and referendum revenue sorted by operating expenditures. So, we are not in Edina. We're number 90th on this list. There is some room here for improvement in our school. We're at, $8,323. And, of course, the top school there is at $19,808 on this list as far as expenditures go. So there are many schools that might have been put in this cartoon that would be more accurate than putting Edina in there. Now, if you read across this you will see that there's a referendum rank in here too. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 columns across. And you will see that the number one referendum ranked school is the 6-1 Campbell, and I don't know how you pronounce that.
Tinta.
Huh?
Tinta.
Tinta. Okay. And if you go down the list, you will find that to the 90th one on the expenditure rank, you will see that Edina's referendum per pupil is number 13. If you go over to the next column, you will see the share of the referendum from levy is 100% in both Richfield and Edina, but many of the districts are paying only a portion. Most of the districts are paying only a portion of their levy, and that's in the next column. So for you up to Morris, and you find that 47.9% is from their own levy, and the balance of 53 or 52.1 is paid for by the state. That's their equalization coming into play. And I have no problems with that, except that you must recognize that there are 80 if I remember correctly, 80 different school districts without a cap. Without a cap. Now, the ones that I'm particularly concerned about, the governor offered to raise the percentage of the cap from 18.6%, which is current law, to 28%. There are some schools, districts, that that does not affect, because they were grandfathered in at a higher rate than would be available even after the offer from the governor. And I think that we have to correct that so that a number of schools that have been left out will be included in any possible referendum levies that they might want to have done. There is, of course, one other thing that I might mention when we're looking at the amount that are spent here. Most of the higher expenditures in the ranking are outstate Minnesota, most of them. And yet I know that, because I have a cabin that's at Hackensack, Longville, Reamer, that the cost of living in those areas is considerably less. And so that's another factor that I think that we ought to be looking at, the ability giving the local districts that are still within, still not affected by the recent offer, the ability to raise their cap. If they need additional revenue, at least it would give them an opportunity to raise some more. Don't like taxing myself, but if that's the only way we can get some money, why, that's maybe what we have to do. And now I would be happy if someone else would say something here.
Representative Earhart, who would you like to be your first testifier?
Representative Sincora, my name is Tom Berge. I'm the Director of Finance and Operations for Minnetonka Schools.
Welcome, Mr. Berge.
Chairperson Sincora, committee members, I have a short PowerPoint presentation. I'd like to take a few minutes to run through to kind of share with you what has been occurring with funding in metro districts versus that of non-metro districts. And really the watershed event that occurred occurred in 1994 when the legislature instituted referendums caps as a way of equalizing funding among school districts. And that occurred even though the Supreme Court decision that reported out in 1993 did not require it. And the strategy has been very successful. Basically, what has happened is that the referendum between metro and non-metro districts has been significantly reduced. And to show what's happened, we've identified six metro and six non-metro districts, six West Metro in particular, because I'm familiar with those districts, and compared to six similar non-metro districts, looking at Eden Prairie, Edina, Hopkins, Minnetonka, Orono, and Wayzata, compared to Duluth, Hibbing, Mankato, Moorhead, Rochester, and St. Cloud. Looking at general education funding, because that's the core of our funding, and general education funding includes three components. It includes the basic allowance, it includes categorical funding, and it includes referendum revenue. And if we take a look at what has been happening with the basic formula allowance, taking into consideration the adjustments that have been made over the years with referendum and roll-in and roll-out of various costs, the six West Metro districts identified had a 40% increase, and the six non-metro districts had basically the same increase. Statewide, there was about a 40% overall increase in the basic formula allowance. Looking at categorical funding, and these are these specialty items that are included in the general education aid and levy calculations. Looking at the six West Metro districts, the per pupil amount actually declined by $96 per pupil over that 10-year period, whereas the six non-metro districts had an increase of $196 per pupil, or about a 64% increase. Districts in the 95th percentile and above, 17 districts, received an excess of $1,700 in categorical funding. In the 5th percentile and below, five of the six West Metro districts were in that 5th percentile and below, received $121 or less. Looking at the referendum, and this includes that $415 transfer that occurred in 2001, the six West Metro districts actually had a decline of $76 per pupil, and the non-metro six had an increase of $238 per pupil. Now, summing all of this together, the categorical, the basic, and the referendum, the six West Metro districts had funding went up by 25% compared to the non-metro districts of almost 45%. If the West Metro group of districts would have received the same increase, we'd have an additional $991 per pupil. Just looking at what's happened with the ranking of students, the ranking of expenditures, and Representative Earhart made reference to this. In 92-93, if we take the average per pupil amount that was being spent by the six West Metro districts, it would have ranked 81st in the state. The six non-metro districts would have ranked 176. That's out of 414 districts. Since that time, over the past 10 years, and this is based on school profiles data, the ranking of the average expenditure for the six metro districts would have increased to 118, a change of 37 points in the ranking, and the six non-metro would have dropped by 37 points, or down to 139 in the ranking, and that's out of 342 school districts. And this change occurred because of the way categorical funding was distributed, because of the caps and the referendum. And basically, those two items reduced the overall increase for this group of metro districts to 25% as compared to almost 45% for their non-metro counterparts. And where the impact has been felt in particular has been on staffing. It's made an impact on staffing ratios. 10 years ago, there was an $847 difference in the amount available for the metro versus the non-metro, 20% differential. And that differential really implicitly recognized the operating cost differential, the fact that it costs more to provide the same services in the metro district versus the non-metro district. When we take a look at the staffing ratio, this isn't class size, this is just the ratio of professional staff to students. This West Metro group in 92-93 had 15.7 students per professional staff. The non-metro was about the same, and the state average was about the same. And this was when there was a 20% differential in terms of the amount of funding between the metro and non-metro districts. Now that difference has declined to 3.9%. The funding for the six West Metro districts went up by $612 more per pupil over the past 10 years than did funding for the six West Metro group of districts. In terms of what impact it has, the professional staffing ratio now for West Metro stands at 14.7, and it's actually down a little bit from 10 years ago because of the categorical funding for reduced class size in kindergarten through grade 3. But the non-metro actually has dropped more. They have one fewer students per staff. The state average is 8/10. Doesn't seem like a lot until you translate it into teaching staff. If in the aggregate the six West Metro districts could have been staffed at the state average, those districts could have hired a total of 174 more teachers. Or if staffed at the same ratio as the non-metro group, those six that I identified, we could have hired 220 more teachers among the six districts. Critical for our schools is this concept, this operating cost differential, and you've heard us talk about this before. I've been here before talking about this various issue. And basically it's the higher wages that we have to pay that make it more expensive to operate in the metro area. It costs us more to employ the same staff. And approximately 85% of our budget is personnel. When we look at the actual difference in hourly rate that's paid to a non-metro versus metro school district for the very same positions, it's about 18% more to employ the same positions in a metro district versus a non-metro district. And the same difference, actually a much larger difference, exists in the private sector. There the variance for the same jobs runs closer to 32%. We take a look at the impact of this difference in funding. If the district I represent had received $612 more per pupil, we would have had an additional $5.4 million in additional revenues. Last Thursday night, our board met on budget recommendations and reduced our operating budget by $3.2 million, made significant changes in how our middle school and high school operates. If we would have received 44%, 45% rather than 25%, we'd have over $8.4 million in additional revenue. And the important thing to recognize is that the focus has to change from dollar equity to educational equity. And we have to recognize that it doesn't cost the same amount to provide an equal educational opportunity. It's going to vary from region to region. And the governor's task force on school finance actually had this as a recommendation in their proposal. So our proposal, the proposal from Representative Earhart is to remove the referendum cap. The governor's budget recognizes the referendum cap must be increased, and most likely we feel it's to accommodate the difference in operating cost differentials. Unfortunately, the 28% cap excludes six metro districts grandfathered in 1994. And the thing is, the other districts that are already above the cap are excluded from the cap because of their eligibility for sparsity revenue. And removing the cap would enable the grandfathered metro districts to address the documented operating cost differentials that were implicitly funded in 1994 by that 20% differential in general ed revenue. And I think the important thing to keep in mind is that the pre-cap funding formula was ruled not unconstitutional in August of 1993. So in summary, the larger referendums implicitly recognized the fact that an operating cost differential existed. We were able to hire about the same number of staff, had about the same staffing ratios as other districts throughout the state. And a significant difference has occurred. We've only had a 25% versus a 45% funding increase, and that's really impacted what we're able to do. It's resulted in above average staffing ratios, and removal of that referendum cap will enable metro districts to address the operating cost differentials and provide staffing equity for all districts. So with that, I'll turn it back to you, Representative Bear.
Representative Bear. Superintendent Dragstad.
Chairperson Sikora, committee members, it's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. Tom Berge and Representative Arrett have covered a lot of the details, but I want to just speak briefly to how it impacts a school district like the school district I represent. I'm Superintendent Edina Public Schools. One of the things that is quite difficult for us to express to our community is this whole issue of when a few years ago when they said we have a referendum cap and we are doing that because of the equity issues around the state of Minnesota. And at that time, 3 years ago when I was a president of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, I brought together for the first time all the representatives of the political groups in the state of Minnesota that have to do with finance. We brought together CMREA, Lake Superior Group, and I'm missing someone else, an MSD, and said, what are the issues that are common to all of us that we can have an interest in and support? And in that very healthy discussion about how funding occurs in the state of Minnesota, a lot of myths were sort of eliminated. And in a sense, one of the myths being what are the high-spending districts and what are the low-spending districts and what are the high-revenue districts and low-revenue districts. But the other issue that we pushed hard for, and I personally pushed hard for, was that we understand equity. I think sometimes speaking from AMSD has not stood in the way in the last couple of years for the equity funding. But what we are seeing as we see the equity funding continue on is that, in a sense, the equity funding goes only one way. And so in the last couple of years, when 80 districts were added to the no referendum cap, when we were told at the legislature that we were not going to raise the cap, and then somehow if you're a sparsity district, you have no referendum cap, it is quite hard to explain to our parents and our communities about why we have a referendum cap. If it is to hold down the expenditures, then I think if you look at the data, which shows that in a sense, 87 of the highest expenditure districts in the state right now are non-metro. And 46 of the 50 highest expenditure districts in the state are non-metro. Now, having said that, referendums have worked. And expanding that without any options has allowed these districts to come up with the expended or the funds that they need to keep their school districts functioning. Unlike a district like the one I'm in, we have simply at the mercy of the legislature right now. We cannot raise we're at the referendum cap. We cannot raise any additional funds. We are totally at the mercy of the legislature giving us some small amount of money, which it has been a small amount of money, none for the last 2 years, and then before that, not a lot. And we can't even go back to our constituents to ask for money. So when we're sitting at $1,400 in referendum and someone is sitting at $2,800 in referendum, and then we hear the reason we have to hold those high-spending districts down, we would say that 87 out of 100 that are high-spending districts that are, and a lot of those have referendum possibilities. So we think we've worked very closely from AMSD with the other districts in the state, and all we're asking now is to have the opportunity to raise the money that we need to fund our schools. If you look at in terms of that funding, we are not going to cost the state of Minnesota much money at all in terms of raising the referendum. Right now, 16 of the 30 AMSD districts get 95% of the referendum money is from local dollars, and 12 of the 30 districts either have 99% or higher. We are not tapping the state funds either for equity or for money on the referendum equity formula.
Superintendent Drake, Seth, we do have a question from Representative Hyde Gergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Earhart, thank you for bringing this forward. It's always good to know that, we've heard from my end the rural schools are complaining as well. So whatever we have in play, and I think Representative Sikora, you've been very fair. You've had an open ear at all times. We have a suburban district yesterday in talking about declining enrollment, how it affects their district. Talking about referendums, you have a difficult, I mean, your hands are tied. I have districts, and represent Mr. Tynes, go see you again. It's been a while since your wrestling days at Broughton. But anyways, but we all have a problem. I'm glad we're presenting. I'm glad you're presenting. And I'm not going to sit here and fight against you. Too often we're doing that. We're pointing the finger at each other. And that's not solving the problem. You have a problem. Representative Clinton's district has a problem, and so do we. Our problem is with referendum in 01. Just to give an example, just Minnewaska in 01, they took 46% of the property wealth away from them. They can't pass a referendum because there's no property wealth left. And Mr. Tynes, you can identify with the situation. We took the cabins and all the land from the farmers off of it. So my question for you, to make this a question, do you think that we need to look, and I hate to say this as a Republican, Representative Sikora, do we need to revisit the Anderson miracle of going back in 01, we had a 32% levy. Right now, even with the governor's proposal, we're at, I think, in 04 at 83% state funded. In 08, if you spin out the numbers, we're going to be looking at 78%. And Mr. I think one of the analysts can probably correct me, but we're going down that road already. Do you think it may be time to revisit what we were doing previous? Because what we have done since has pitted rural against urban and urban against suburban, and we don't need to be there. We should be here for all of the kids. And to do something that's good for you, that's good for Representative Clinton's district and mine. And the only thing I can think of, and you folks deal with it more than I do, the only thing that I can come up with is going back to what we had done previous, looking at the general levy. It used to be at 31-32%. And when you did those levies, you didn't have to worry about the referendums. You didn't have to worry about what was exempt and what wasn't. It was a general levy. You think that is the right course to take?
First of all, I would want to say very emphatically that I am for strong funding for all kids in Minnesota. If you were out at the rally a week ago, you heard me say that very publicly to a lot of people, and that the problem that we're finding ourselves in is all over the state because of a broken funding system. And the funding system you basically change the funding system without backfilling it, is all you know. I mean, it's nothing new to you. You didn't backfill it, and so now we have no money in that system, and so we're all scavenging for every little piece of dollars that we can get. None of us really want to be here from around the state asking you to put more referendum money out there, or asking us to pass referendums in districts that it's very difficult. And I understand, as I said, that the discussion that we had among those representatives from all these groups over the last few years, and actually we're meeting again tomorrow, is we're all hurting. And I'm coming here saying, if you can't fix the problem, and I hope you fix the problem, if you can't fix the problem, I have no other choice. I have no money. And so I'm coming to you begging for more money.
Thank you.
All right. Did you have further testimony, Superintendent?
I'll go on to Superintendent Thine.
Go ahead, Superintendent, and please introduce yourself for the...
Hello, I'm Chairperson Sikora, members of the committee. My name is John Thine, and I'm the Superintendent of Roseville Area Schools. I'm pleased to be here today, and it's a privilege to follow two of the best minds in education today as speakers. At my home, not only am I known as the superintendent of schools, but I'm also known as a professional beggar because I'm going through the community begging for money. And while these two gentlemen have talked about the numbers, I want to talk about the faces behind the numbers. Because when we make cuts in our district, in all of our districts, not just in the metro, but throughout the state, there are faces behind every one of those numbers. And the other night at a school board meeting, I had the difficult opportunity that almost every superintendent and every board in the state had to face, and that is making reductions. And those reductions are very painful. And I want to tell you that when you have to go into a room and you have to tell a kindergarten teacher that there's not going to be an aide this year because we're going to save $14,000, but of the 25 students that she has in that kindergarten class, 12 to 13 of them are from homes where English is a second language, who've never been in America until this year. We're so privileged in Roseville to have the University of Minnesota housing within our district borders. But with that privilege comes some opportunities. We like to call them opportunities. The opportunities happen to be that every 3 years we're able to welcome a brand new group of graduate students. And with those graduate students, they bring bright, smiling faces, students with them. Right now in that building, there are 57 different languages that are spoken. I happened to go to the first day of kindergarten last year, and there was a little girl, and she had a string around her neck, and on that was a card. And in English was the word bathroom. On the other side, in Japanese, I assume it said bathroom. And there were a number of key words. And when this little girl would need something, she would point to the Japanese word, and our teacher would know what she wanted. I showed back up at Christmas holiday time, the Christmas break, and I said, what happened to that little girl? Did she leave? No, she's out playing with the rest of the kids. You would never have believed that that could happen. I guess the reason I'm here today is to say, I don't really care where the money comes from, but I need some money. And I need money for kids. I need money for staff. I need money to offer the programs that we have become, that our parents and our families have come to expect. This is getting very, very serious. All the easy cuts, all the easy places to take out dollars. And I'm not talking just metro schools. I'm talking the state of Minnesota. There are no easy places left. We need the opportunity to generate some dollars someplace because kids are at risk and families are at risk. And I told our staff I was coming down here today, and they said, oh, geez, don't go because you're just going to get lambasted because we must be one or two within the state in spending. And I told our staff we were 56th in spending. They didn't believe it. They said, that's not so. Years ago, we were right up near the top. What happened? How did you screw this up, Tyne? Well, I won't take that credit alone. I'll share that with others. We just lowered our expenditures. When I told them that we were 20th in referendum, it was hard to believe because at one time we were up near the top, one or two. So I guess what I'm trying to say, we need some help. I'd really appreciate any support you can give. If you want to just give personal checks, we take those too. But a legislative action would be very, very helpful, and I ask the committee to please consider this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Fine, to that point, and I think your school districts are probably ready to do that where we are. I just got a call from the superintendent of Glenwood last night. They have raised $42,000 to keep their school in Glenwood going, and they've consolidated a number of years ago. I think you're familiar with it. But that you're not off the mark on that. Thank you.
Are there any further questions from members of the committee? None. Anything any of you wish to add? And did any of you wear a hat today?
Did we wear
a hat today? It occurred to me we might pass it.
Oh,
you leave.
No, we are here begging. I think Superintendent Tyne and myself. I mean, it really is. When you get to a situation where the students in the state of Minnesota deserve a solid education system. I don't think you disagree with that.
No.
And I said it the other day on the rally, you know, that it doesn't matter what their ethnicity, what their home life, what their poverty level, what family situation they live in. They want help. And then they don't have, you know, they don't have Democrat or Republican stamp on their forehead when I see them in my schools. I just see kids. And so however you can help us, you know, we'll be gladly work with you, and we'll gladly take whatever you can give us and make it, use it wisely and help the education of our kids. Thank you.
And obviously there's nobody more devoted to kids than this group of people right here. So Representative Klinzing does have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that you mentioned the governor's proposal briefly, which is not to lift the cap. I mean, not to eliminate it, but to lift it. Just wondering if you could do a comparison, a kind of a pro-con of either of the governor's proposal versus the eliminating it entirely.
Who would like to tackle that one?
Well, here's the
well, I've been
Superintendent.
Representative Sikora, thank you. The governor's proposal raising 28% will do nothing at all for my district and five other districts.
Right.
It will help, and so you raise the, so we're still going to be coming to you and saying we need some money because you control the money for us right now the way the system is set. It's an improvement. I mean, obviously, for a lot of districts who are between that 18th percentile and 28th percentile, it's an improvement. But I think the comments made earlier that just because you have the capability doesn't necessarily mean that you can pass it. You know, and I think that's, I think we hear that from all around the state. I mean, and I, so, but for us, we need to have the opportunity to try. In our district and districts that are above the cap. So somehow the number has to be raised, eliminated, so that percentage has to be relooked at to allow districts like, that are excluded from any help here some relief to go back to our taxpayers.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank goodness that Representative Heidgerken knows Superintendent Tyne already, because I had warned Superintendent Tyne that if anybody from the rural area is going to give him a hard time, it would be Representative Heidgerken. So I'm so thrilled that we have this relationship. And also, I want to say, when I first came to the legislature, I think there was a lot of thought that if we could just get money for all schools from these, you know, districts like I represent and like we have before us, that then there would be enough money for everybody. And so I'm not glad that we're where we are, but I am glad that we at least finally are realizing that we have to raise all boats.
Oh, Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just went, just out of curiosity, I'm quite familiar with the rural numbers, and I have oftentimes used Minnewaska, and I know they're tired of hearing that word. But I have 12 other school districts I represent, and each one that the governor's proposal affects differently. But there's only one thing, whether regardless of delinking, or we talk about sparse EA or a compensatory or any one of those components, equity. The one that the one issue I want to see how it affects the urban areas. In regards to staff development now, a year ago we were given the ability to use it with flexibility. Now with the 2% requirement again of having that in the general for staff development, in my rural districts it really affects them dramatically because it takes that flexibility away from and ties up almost all the money earmarked, the new money from the governor, it's earmarked there. Is it affecting you to that degree as well? Any one of you?
I can answer
just
that.
Mr. Tyne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Staff development in our district is so critical that because of the population that we serve, we look at it as an investment. And really, removing it has helped a little bit because it does give you some freedom. But we really need those dollars to be invested in our staff. Because the challenges that they're facing, I'm going to be honest with you, that's just not covered in 101 at any university that I'm aware of. So it's really kind of, it's like a lot of private businesses. When you have staff show up, you need to invest in them. And it has to be a continual investment, too. It's almost like going to the doctor. You just don't go to the dentist once and say, well, I'm done going forever. I never need to go again. And we find that with our staff. We really need to keep them up to date and ready to go. It does help, though. What really helps? Extra dollars on the formula helps everybody.
Exactly.
Gentlemen, we have some people who wish to speak in opposition. If you would just move back, and in case there's more questions after they have spoken, if you would just move back into some other seats, and then I would ask Jerry Ness and Sam Walseth from MREA to come up, please. And then Brad Lundell, you will be following them. Welcome, Mr. Ness. Are you first?
Thank you. Representative Sikora, Chairperson Sikora, and committee. We do have some concerns, visit with Mr. Dragseth and Mr. Stein quite often, and we have kids at heart as well, and we have some real concerns because of the 2001 tax reform really created an unfair playing field for rural districts, and with no more ag, Campbell Tinta was mentioned earlier, they lost 92% of their tax value because it's 92% of their property is in ag land. We also have Minnewaska is in our MREA as well, Alexandria, Grand Rapids, Brainerd, many seasonal rec as well. And I am a half-time executive director with MREA, and I'm also a half-time superintendent as well at West Central Area Schools right north of Minnewaska. And we have Elbow Lake, Wendell, Barrett, Hoffman, and Kensington, and some other concerns that we have with referendums specifically is Elbow Lake, Barrett, Hoffman have all gone through major sewer, water, road repairs, different things that they're doing there. And our taxpayers are getting right up to here with paying for taxes. And unfortunately, they could vote no on a school referendum. That's one thing where they can vote no. So we're very concerned with that as well. Right now, the Metro, according to our numbers, their average referendum is $920, whereas the rural is $440. And yes, we do have districts that are receiving sparsity. We're aware of that. But we also just have some real concerns about raising that cap. And if it's not fully equalized up to that cap, it's unfair to low wealth districts. So that's our concerns.
Mr. Walson.
Madam Chair, Stan Walsh, also with MREA. The conversation's been very good here today. Representative Heifer, we appreciate your comments, and I don't think I need to belabor the conversation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brad Lundell. I'm Executive Director of Schools for Equity and Education. I'm a full-time Executive Director, but I think some people think I'm a half-time Executive Director. I don't know. I too want to, I think we're coming here today with, I've talked and discussed this issue a lot of times over the years and not always using my inside voice. So I think that we certainly want to come today with a different angle on this issue. I think in our organization we clearly say there needs to be a cap, and that cap should be negotiable. But I think, is 18.6 the right cap? Is 28%, is 12%, is 22%. I think we need to find a way to find what the right cap is going to be. But I think that previous speakers and Dr. Dragseth, who I've worked very closely with over the last couple of years, and I really want to commend him for the work he's done in trying to bring all the education organizations together, I think we do need to talk about this in conjunction with increases on the basic formula. People tend to want to look at specific parts of formulas as opposed to looking at how all the formulas fit together. Clearly, the referendum is part of school funding. We've worked to equalize that. We've brought more fairness to the system. But it still remains a function that referenda should be a last resort and not a first resort. And money on the formula, categorical funding that works, those are the kinds of things that go to all school districts in the way that money should be expended. Should there be local expenditure or local options? Absolutely. Should those local options be equalized? Absolutely. But we should first start from a strong base of state funding, and even looking at discretionary levies or bringing back the general ed levy to find out what the appropriate local share in that should be as well. I think the governor's task force, and I've been kind of a Johnny One Note on this, we were disappointed that the governor's task force did not come out with something that was more specific in how education should be funded and approached. In that report, it talked about many of the things that previous testifiers and have talked about, one of them being the cost of living. clearly part of the referendum does deal with the different costs of living in different parts of the state. But should we be funding that up front through an adjustment of the formula, or should we be leaving that to kind of arbitrarily to be addressed by referenda unequally within the metropolitan area? I think one of the things that makes Minnesota different as we look at some of these issues, and I've studied a lot of how equity and adequacy lawsuits have been filed in other states. One of the things in Minnesota that makes it different is the wide disparity of property wealth within the metropolitan area and just outside the metropolitan area. Usually if you look at property wealth distributions in other states, it's a rural or urban or suburban, but things are far more monolithic than they are here in Minnesota, where you have districts that abut each other in the west metro suburbs. I think of Rockford, for instance, which is right outside the metropolitan area, with a referendum of $13 per kid, and property wealth that's unbelievably low. And I think Princeton would be another district where Representative Erickson represents extremely low property wealth. And then you go 10 miles in toward the cities, and you'll see districts with greatly different abilities. That's why I think the general ed formula is really the place to look for in this, and to reduce reliance on the referenda. Should there be a referendum? Absolutely. Should it be equalized? Yes. Should it be capped? We would also believe that it should be capped as well. And also, I think the other thing we need to talk about is discretionary levy authority. In our organization, we've been kind of timid about talking about discretionary levy authority. This year, we support the concept of discretionary levy authority. We think it should be equalized at a rate higher than what the governor comes with. But again, this is another place where issues that face all districts can be addressed through board discretionary authority. And we can maybe do a wide range of board discretionary authorities instead of having this one kind of catch-all referenda that is that can be very, very arbitrary, and in some cases talks about not just breadth of services but price per unit input. And I think that those are things that we need to talk about. We're supporting the governor's task force being continued and coming, using that framework that was developed and trying to cost that out to a greater extent to look at what it is needed to educate a kid in the state of Minnesota, what kind of local effort should be required in the basic formula, and then what other things can districts do on both board and voter-approved levies to augment those resources. And so I'll gladly stand for any questions, but I think today the message that we all want to come here with is that the general ed formula simply, this issue becomes a lot less important with more support on the general ed formula.
One quick question, you can answer it with a yes or no. Should we be taxing the ag land?
Madam Chair, I think that's one of the parts of the 2001 that...
Not a yes or no, Mr. Lundell.
Well, I just wanted to contextualize my answer, but I would say that all the land that was taken off the rolls in 2001 should be considered to be put back on, and I would support that.
Which means you would want the recreational property back on also.
Absolutely.
Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my questions actually would be for the superintendents, Dr. Kine and Dr. Dragsa.
Representative Heidgerken, were your questions of these gentlemen? Oh.
Oh, wait.
Sorry, I was a little slow on the uptake. Superintendents.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Superintendents, I come from southern Minnesota. I got parts of the majority of six different school districts. Four of my school districts are on page 10 in this funding, and one of them is on page 8, and the other one's, I think, on page 7. The range in funding differences is, I think, the low difference is $1,800 less per student, and I think it's up over $2,000 per student for the other ones, and that's compared to the other schools. And there's a broad difference, of course, also in the facilities that your types of school districts have compared to what we have, and I realize there's more kids and that sort of thing, and those are funded differently than the dollars we're talking about here. So it comes to mind about the differences in that funding and what it's doing is on a per child basis. And one question I have, you talked about the higher the higher cost of living, and I understand all that being up here and being from Hayfield. Do you, either one of you, have a difficult time hiring teachers? Is it hard to get teachers to come here because of the high cost of living?
Mr. Durkin.
Chairperson Sikora, Representative Welch. That obviously, I've had that question asked me every time I come here. Do we get students who, or do we get teachers who want to work in our district? We do not have a difficulty getting teachers to work in our district because we're in a metropolitan area. And the reality is, the metropolitan area of students, and I grew up in a small community, and I left a small rural community to come to the metropolitan area because I wanted that style of life. And yet, many times, when I go back to a small rural community and it's quiet and there's no traffic and there's no congestion and there's no other, not a high cost of living, I can buy a house quite cheaply, I wonder why I made that change. But the reality is, you are going to have, in small rural Minnesota, a more difficult time to get teachers to come to your area and to stay there. And is that because of the remoteness of that community from a large metropolitan area? Is it the salaries that they get in those communities? I mean, I don't know. That's something I guess you would have to answer. But we do not have a difficulty getting them. The quality is another issue, all over the state. In terms of facilities, and you mentioned that, I just want to comment a couple things. Our youngest building in our district is 33 years old. Our high school is much younger than a lot of high schools that have been built in the state of Minnesota in the last year. I drive around the state a lot, as you do, and there are a lot of beautiful high schools out there that are in rural Minnesota. And we would love to have some of the facilities that are in some of those schools. So, facilities, if you're in an older community, you have older facilities. I mean, that's really, we have to keep them up. That money does not affect our operating budget, as you know. I mean, they're two, as we know, they're both separate things. We talked about the difference, $1,800 to $2,000 difference in revenue or expenditures, and I don't know which one you meant there, but I do believe, cost of living. I mean, if we take 18% of $8,000, you got $1,440 difference right there. And that's about the average price, average expenditure in the state is about $7,600. So we're not that far off from you in terms when you take the cost differential out.
All right, Representative. Oh, you have a follow up? Representative Demers.
Maybe a couple of you, Madam Chair.
Well,
that's okay.
Go ahead.
I guess my.
10 minutes left.
Okay, I understand the part about teachers. Actually, the school I come from, we have a lot of teachers there that 30 plus years and end up living there, and I understand why when I'm back and forth on weekends, believe me. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is that I think in terms of arguing that because of the higher cost of living, we need to have more money for these urban and suburban schools because of the high cost of living for teachers. I would re-examine that argument when you don't have a difficulty keeping your teachers. There are plenty of teachers here. That's just a comment that I would make. Another question I have is, what do you offer either one of your school districts for vocational-type programs? Do you have a wide range of vocational programs available?
Superintendent Tyne.
Sure. Could I answer your first question? I didn't get a chance. Ken hogged the microphone.
He's quick.
Some of that, one of the things that I guess I'd like to say is we have absolutely no trouble recruiting in most cases, but we do have trouble keeping. Because what happens, a lot of folks, there's the old saying, how do you keep them down on the farm? We find it's the other way around. A lot of people stop and they say, oh boy, I don't want to live in this environment. It's too busy, too big. I'm going back to Osaka, Bruton, wherever it happens to be. So in that case, it's a little bit different. Vocationally, we belong to 916, which is a Northeast Metro. It's a group of 10 metropolitan school districts that joined together to offer high-cost, low-incident programming and special education and vocational. And we do offer a vocational, very extensive vocational printing program at Roseville Area High School. In fact, it's state-of-the-art, we think, and we're very, very proud of it. In fact, it's a little-owned business. If you need T-shirts for Hayfield's wrestling team, let us know. We'll make them up for you.
Thank you, but we have a business in Hayfield that does that.
Oh.
I would not take that away from them. I think in the interest of time, I'm going to get to my point. We don't have those kinds of offerings at schools that I represent down in Hayfield. Now, Rochester may have some of these types of things. I guess other things that would come to mind for me is, how many languages do you offer? My schools offer one, probably. How many different types of art classes do you offer? My schools offer art classes, maybe one for each grade. In Hayfield, we've expanded. Now you can take art from 9 through 12, which is a big advancement. When I was there, we had art in 7th and 8th. How many different theater acting type courses do you have? I don't think any in our district can offer those types of things. And how many different levels and offerings of some biology can you take to satisfy a biology requirement? We have one. We have biology. And I think larger schools have many, many, many different offerings that give you variety. And chemistry, and then literature courses, how many different things. The point that I'm making is that an adequate education in everybody's mind is somewhat different. I think to some, it's not adequate unless you offer 3, 4, 5 different languages to kids to take. Where I come from, we offer one, that's great, because the kids get their language and it's good. And I think being able to offer a vocational program in printing is excellent.
Mm-hmm.
We aren't able to do that sort of thing. And maybe that's one of the reasons that we do get by for up to $2,000 less per child, is because we offer a good, basic, solid education. And the one question I would have liked to have asked would be graduation percentages. I'm not going to go there. That's information we have out there. Our schools are well over 90% and do very well out there. So we have a good, solid, basic education for quite a bit less money, and I think sometimes we need to evaluate how we look at what is appropriate and proper education.
Chairperson Sikora, can I respond to that?
Briefly, please, sir.
Okay, briefly. One of the big myths, and we offer 7 foreign languages in our district, but the reality is staffing, it makes more difference how many foreign languages you offer is whether you can track the teacher. Because when a teacher is in a classroom, you're paying X number of dollars for that student. It's a staffing ratio. So if I have 400 staffing hours, if I staff that with 400 math classes, it costs the same money as if I have 200 math classes, 100 science classes, and 100 world language classes. So the myth that it costs more to have more foreign languages is a myth. It does not cost us any more per student to have it. The difference is we have a larger high school, and so you have more kids who will take that course, and if they don't, you know, if nobody wants Chinese, and there's only 7 of them who do, and we do that in a cooperative manner, then you don't do it. So, and if you look at the large cities outstate that have comparable enrollment to us, 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000, they have the same opportunities for multiple courses as we do. And our classes, we have maybe 2 or 3. A theater, we have 1. Or we have 2 levels of biology. We have virtually no vocational. We don't spend that money on that, and part of that is because we're with Intermediate 287. But class size is something that we don't have, that you do in rural Minnesota. And you do that because of the size of your school. So a lot of your schools are running with class sizes in some of your elementary schools of 14, 16, 18, because you have no other kids. And it isn't that you want to do that. It's just the nature of it is. Our class sizes are running 25 to 30 to 35. And because we have no money and we have this number of kids, and the cost of doing that is expensive. So I think we have all pointed out that there are problems in the funding structure. And it's not easy. I mean, I can complain, you can, and everybody else can complain. But somehow the funding system, if you're not going to fix it by kind of throwing out the old one and do it, then all of us are going to be right here saying, put it on the formula, as Brad Lindahl said, give me it on the formula, that's great, at least I can do what I want to do. Raise the cap a little so we have opportunities, and we're not in disagreement with that.
Madam Chair, if I could, just one last comment. Dr. Regseth, you made my point. That wasn't about to say better or worse, that was my point, that there are some big differences. I said before, we have to look at education. I think that we have suburban-urban districts that are way different than what we have in rural Minnesota, the different challenges, different opportunities. And I think sometimes what got me going in this is a lot of the comparisons, us against them. And I pointed those things out because there are a lot of differences. And I'm not sure that that's a good direction to go, but I think overall we got some challenges in terms of funding education. And there are some vast differences in the types of education that we have in the state. And that was my point, which you made for me. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm done.
Could I just...
Mr. Time.
One thing. The modern languages that you talked about, and we do, we offer 4, but One that probably most people don't think of is 1,000 students in our district who English is a foreign language to. And that really does have a little bit of a challenge that a lot of the districts aren't faced with. So all of our kids need help, no matter where they're located. Thank you.
Representative Sikora, can I make a comment again? Or are you done?
Quickly. We have okay, quickly, another question.
Quickly, that the... When you look at, you see, I made my point on class size. Right? The differences that we see, and the reason that we get into comparisons, is that all of a sudden you open up 80 districts to unlimited referendum. Why? We also look at the fact the sparsity aid is high. I'm sitting in district, obviously I don't need sparsity aid, I'm not there. But you have, by your decisions, put money in areas that you felt needed it. And yet you've never addressed the cost differential issue or even allow us to have a referendum to go out and ask our own people to do it. That's why we have comparisons. I mean, I'm glad that they got it. But, you know, we want a piece of the pie, too. That's kind of the comment that our community members are saying.
Representative Clinton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems like a large, well, probably the key part of this argument is that the cost is more expensive in the metro. And yet I'm looking at the three schools I represent in the metro, which fall well below $1,000 of expenditures per student of some of the districts you're talking about raising the cap for. And these are metro area schools, and I know a goal is equity, and I'm just wondering how, when you've got, if cost differentials are the maybe the main part of the argument, yet you've got similar districts with the same costs that incurred who are not able to levy that much. How does your proposal, I guess, achieve the equity that you're hoping to achieve?
Representative, I think we have worked at... Excuse me, Chairperson Sikora.
No problem.
I think we have worked for equity. I think the AMSC districts have not opposed any of the equity issues that you've done, the equalizing the referendum, the sparsity aid, the option to have unlimited referendum. We didn't oppose those. But when you look at the other huge cost differential that are in school districts, it is the age of the staff. And the longer they stay with us, the more expensive they are. So if you take 80 teachers in one district and 80 teachers in another district and say, this district, because it's cheaper, is more efficient, that's sort of the fuzzy mathematics that we saw in a recent study. And it is, you know, if you pay one group, 80 teachers, $50,000, another one, they're all starting out and they're $35,000, yeah, you're going to have a huge cost differential between these two districts. And I don't know the particulars of your district, and I would have to look at where are your people in that structure, and where are our people in that structure, and we're probably going to spend more because of an aging staff.
All right, and the last question, Representative Heidgerken, you get to open and close
the
question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's a... again, we talk about numbers, they can become very fuzzy. And when you refer to sparsity aid, they can be very fuzzy. When you look at 13% of the schools that get sparsity, 13% at one end of the spectrum are getting sparsity, 13% of the sites, school districts, have less than 1% of the pupils. That's something to keep in mind when you're talking about the total picture. 99% of the kids are pretty close. And the sparsity end of it, it's site-based. They're so sparse. School buses run over many, many miles, as Superintendent Time was. But you're talking about a very, very small part of the budget. You're only talking about 1% of the kids. And that's something to keep in the proper perspective when you're talking about the total number of kids. But then again, I don't want to go there, but I think we all have a problem. We realize that. And I will... I had another question for Mr. Lundell, but I will forego that question because I think it's somewhat been covered to some degree, but it has to do with the disparity aid.
Thank you, Representative. And we will be discussing all of these to some extent, but we do need to get to the remainder of the governor's bill today. So, gentlemen, thank you very much for your patience and your time and your excellent explanations.
Thank you.
might even say thank you, members. And
your bill will be laid over for consideration.
Thank you.
Dr. Melcher. I take it you're flying solo today.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. We do have a number of other staff from the department who will kind of come in on different articles of the bill. When we left off, we were on Article 7, which is on page Article 6 on page 142 of the bill. And the governor is not recommending any changes in Article 6. That's the nutrition article, and so the appropriation language that you see there is simply maintaining the current statutory formulas and fully funding them. And the next article, Article 7, is quite similar. Again, there are no language changes being recommended by the governor in the library area. The one change in the appropriations from current law is the Electronic Library of Minnesota on line 20 of page 143. And there the governor is recommending an increase of $1.5 million for the biennium over current law, and that is to replace some federal dollars that can no longer be used for that purpose in order to maintain the actual overall level of funding for the program at the current level. And with that, I'd like to move into Article 8, and Ms. Carlson is going to join me here to do with that one.
Chair, committee members, Karen Carlson, Department of Education. You'll recall when I went through the governor's change items that there were two main items here. One concerns screening and one's the school readiness program. And so on page 144, section 1 starts in on the screening initiative, and that is kind of a three-part initiative. Line 7 lowers the age from 3.5 to 3. So the target, you remember that this is a mandated program once prior to school entrance, and so we're targeting children between 3 and 4 years old. The second part of that proposal starts on line 18, and that's the assignment of the student ID, the MARS number, to the children at the time of screening. And then the third part of that initiative is in section 2, where we are offering three differential reimbursement rates depending on the age of the child screened as an incentive to screen at a younger age. Next page, the next initiative, the School Readiness Initiative, section 3. The eligible children on line 5 for this program are 3-year-old to kindergarten entrance. You'll recall the focus, we're trying to promote a focus of preparation for kindergarten. That's on lines 10 and 11. The program requirements change from current requirements, and some of you may remember that we had the same language in a bill that didn't get any action last year, so it'll sound redundant, and we worked with the advocacy organizations on the language, particularly the language for the requirements. So now the requirements will be to conduct a child development assessment on each child prior to entrance into the program and once prior to leaving the program. And the
Madam Chair. Ms. Carlson, for a second. What does an assessment consist of when you're working with a child who's barely 3?
Madam Chair, have I gone through the school readiness study in this committee before? I kind of lose track of where I've been with that. But there's a 32 item checklist that we've been doing in a sample of districts. And it I didn't bring it with me today, and I'd be happy to do that some other time for you. But there's 32 items, and they are the teacher rates the proficiency level of shows the skill all the time, shows the skill sometimes, never shows the skill, and over kind of a course of
is this
time.
An assessment that's done at screening? Because the
child no, wouldn't
the,
know.
No,
so
I'm
this
about,
would
okay.
This would be an assessment that's done when the child enters the program.
And tell me, what would the screening look like for a 3-year-old child? Just thinking, there must be some 3-year-olds who don't want anything to do with anybody who's theoretically screening them.
Madam Chair, the screening, we don't have a mandated way of doing screening. We don't have a form that the district or that the department says to the districts they have to use. So they can locally choose what kind of screening tool. And there are, of course, you know, manufactured tools out there of a variety. So they pick their own. And we can show you some examples.
So it varies district by district.
Yep.
Okay.
The second requirement is to adopt and implement the early learning standards that we have just completed. The third requirement is to demonstrate use of a comprehensive curriculum. And what that language was worked out with the advocates. What that means is you've done an assessment on the child. You look at, you know, your group of children. You've assessed. You should use that information to inform what kind of curriculum you use, and the curriculum should be based on, you know, some research tenets, not just some made-up thing that the teacher did. And so that's we had the word intentional in there, and that's kind of a buzzword, intentional curriculum, so we changed it to
okay, just a second, Ms. Carlson. Representative Erickson had a question.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Ms. Carlson, who are the advocate groups to which you're referring?
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, there is a group, MNAFI is the acronym, and that's the Association for Family Educators, and then the Community Ed Organization that has ECFE and school readiness directors and staff.
Thank you.
Some of the requirements are sort of a rewording of old requirements. This statute hadn't been visited since its inception, and it had kind of a lot of wordiness to it that isn't really necessary, and it was also reflected a lot of the, you know, collaborate with this person, the other person, and, you know, all their relatives, and show us how you do that. So we cleaned up some of that. Fourth requirement, then, is to arrange for screening, because screening is not a requirement to enter the preschool program. It's a requirement to enter kindergarten, so some children may not have it.
Representative Grinning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson, I have, having the chance to sit next to Ms. Larson gives me a chance to give some input that I heard her mention to herself. And one is on, it's on page 22, the word intentional. We're wondering if you meant to make that into comprehensive like you did on line 33.
Ms. Carlson.
Oh, thank you for pointing that out. we can certainly do that. That is the same concept, yes. On page 146, then, is the parent requirement, and we made this a little stronger in that, in addition to involving parents, we'd like to have them have a role in planning the program and in making decisions about the program. And let's see, 6 and 7. 6 is coordinate with relevant community-based services, and that's as defined locally. The type of coordination can be defined locally, and the partners can be defined locally. And then in 7, we left language in there to cooperate with adult basic ed and other adult literacy programs, since those have an impact on children's literacy. Section 5, then, the subdivision application and reporting requirements looks like it's all new. It's a rewrite, and is underlined because it moved in the language. It's the same process that we use right now. That is, the district will submit a plan to the commissioner, and the commissioner will approve the plan, and then the money will be given to the district. The content of the plan will change according to the requirements that I just went through, but this isn't a new process for the districts. And that's the same with lines 27 and 28. We now require and will continue to require an annual report. The plan is a biennial plan, so then every year they report. Section 6 is just a slight rewording of the current requirement that, or it's not exactly a requirement, it's a permissive item, that the district may contract with community-based organizations, because, as you know, there isn't, like, a public or a private early childhood system. There's a combination of all sorts of programs out there, and we don't want to not take advantage of those community-based programs that would be appropriate for school readiness purposes. And then we did insert at top page 147 some new language that we would like a copy of that contract then to accompany the plan. We now allow the permit districts to do that, but we don't see the contracts, and so it's kind of confusing in a lot of instances. It's hard to tell what they're using the money for when they don't have the service right there in the district. Section 7, the language that's stricken in Section 7 is redundant to the now requirement that the contract has to be accompanied. That was really some kind of assurance to have in the contract language, and it's not necessary now. Section 8, the program fees, you'll recognize this language from the ECFE statutes, which we, a couple years ago, revised from May to that the districts must adopt a sliding fee schedule. The stricken language, again, is stricken because it's not necessary. The definition of sliding fee schedule is in the first sentence. So, Section 9, this too is intentional to parallel ECFE language. The department must provide technical assistance to the districts. Section 10 refers to the amount of aid that the school readiness program, that the biennial plan has to be submitted to the commissioner in order to get the aid. And on top page 148, there's two technical changes in items 1 and 2. In Section 11, the use of the aid, this too parallels ECFE. This is to get the two programs to use the same definition of program revenue, which is broader, includes more than just the aid. It also includes the fees that are collected from parents in the definition of revenue. And then we start our appropriations in Section 12. First appropriation is the school readiness appropriation, and you'll see the levels for 2006 and 2007. And on page 149, the ECFE amounts of the appropriation are listed, followed by the screening appropriations and the Head Start program. The repealers, the Section 13, Item B, is we have the districts on a every other year schedule. We divide the districts in half, and half submit their plan by May 15th of 1 year, and the rest of them do it the next year. And so that's that repealer is so that nobody misses out on their they continue the current program because they're due on May 15th of this year, and then that group will then start the proposed changes, if they are adopted, a year from next year.
Madam Chair.
Dr. Melcher.
Moving on to Article 9 of the bill, there's only one section there, and that is a change to the equalizing factor for the school-age care levy to adjust for the governor's recommendation to change from a weighted pupil count to an unweighted pupil count, In order to keep the amount of aid and levy the same as under current law, we would change the equalizing factor to reflect that difference in the number of pupils that are being counted. Section 2 of Article 9 is the appropriations section, and all of the appropriations in Article 9 are the same as under current law. The governor is not recommending any changes to the levels of funding for the community education programs. Then moving on to Article 10, we have the self-sufficiency and lifelong learning article. And Sections 1 and 2 of Article 10 are making an adjustment to the adult basic education funding formula to allow the program to retain dollars that would otherwise revert back to the state treasury and cause the level of funding to be below the level that is set in statute as the funding level for adult basic education. So the language essentially says that if there are dollars that are unspent, there's a requirement that a school district must spend 100% of the aid it receives in the program year or the aid is reduced. And if there are reductions of that nature, then those unspent dollars would go back into the statewide cap for the program for the following year, so they would be spent in the following year rather than going back to the state treasury. There's also another provision that puts a limit on the amount of funding per FTE student that a program can receive. And again, any unspent dollars as a result of that cap would go back into the program cap the next year to keep the level of funding at the level it's specified in statute. And Mr. Wagner is going to review briefly the grants for intensive English instruction in Section 3.
Chairperson Sikora, members of the committee, my name is Todd Wagner. I work at the Department of Education. I'm pinch hitting for Barry Schaefer, who's our state director of adult basic ed and who's out doing program monitoring this week. Section 3 establishes a two-year appropriation funded at $1 million per year to fund a reimbursement grant system to programs to provide intensive ESL English language instruction services to refugees. The purpose of this appropriation is to enable programs where those refugees will be served, and most of which currently have waiting lists for English language services, to address the needs of refugees coming from the camp in Thailand, those are Hmong refugees, as well as the steady flow we have of refugees coming from other countries.
Are there any questions on anything to this point? If not, please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, the next article is the state agencies article, and I was looking to get Tammy McGlone down here to say a couple words about that.
Would you be sure to introduce yourself, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Tammy McGlone. I'm with the Department of Education in Section Article 11.
Would you run your name by us a little slower, please?
Sorry, Madam Chair. It's Tammy McGlone.
McGlone. Okay.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Article 11 has the appropriation for the agency operations as on line 22 is the fiscal year 06, and line 23 has 07 amount. We also have some pass-through dollars that we send to the Children's Museum, the Academy of Science. Then there's some dedications that follow for some of the new initiatives the governor has proposed in the agency's budget. We have the appropriation for the Board of Teaching, Board of School Administrators, and then the language that appropriates the federal dollars that we receive. Section 2 covers the appropriation for the state academies. Section 3 covers the Purpich Center. And that would be it for Article 11.
Ms. McGlone, we have a question up here. I think the numbers that we were looking at for the administration of the scholarship tax credit, wouldn't that normally be in the Department of Revenue?
Madam Chair, my understanding of that is that appropriation is coming to our agency, but it's going to be an interagency agreement with the Department of Revenue to cover the cost of administration of the program. And Okay, so Mr. Melcher confirms that that's his recollection as well. So,
so it's sort of an intra-agency deal here?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
So this money is being appropriated for the administration of the scholarship's tax credit by the Commissioner of Education instead of the Department of Revenue, correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. And that the language allows for the appropriation to be transferred to an amount to be agreed to. I think that currently it's our understanding that the Commissioner of Revenue is going to do the administration. I think when the proposal was first presented, they were still discussing how it was going to actually be administered. And as the discussions have continued, the decision has been made that it's best to be administered by the Commissioner of Revenue, and we will do an agreement with them for the administration of the program and transfer funds to them.
Okay, so it's only in this bill to go to the department and then will be transferred to revenue.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
All right. Thank you. Is that it? Are we done?
Madam Chair, we are done reviewing the department bill. In the last hearing that we were here, Commissioner Seagram had asked if the committee had time, if we could spend a few moments dealing with some of the property tax levy impacts of the governor's budget bill, just for information.
Yes, let's do that.
And I have just at the page to have three documents distributed to the committee members, and I'd like to start with the document that's labeled Table 1 at the top. It just provides some statistical background information regarding the property tax impacts of the governor's budget recommendations. I'm not sure if the committee members have the document yet or if it's still being distributed. Okay. The table one at the top of the page is showing the breakdown of the new dollars in the governor's initial budget recommendations and how they break down between property tax increases and state aid increases. And the first year of the biennium is fiscal year 2006. Because the property taxes have essentially already been set for fiscal year 2006, you can see there's a $123 million increase in aid, a $4 million increase in levy. The levy is actually a payable 2006 levy that is recognized early by school districts to pay for the pre-kindergarten transition program, which would be funded in fiscal 06, but in large part with levy from the payable 06 levy. In the second year of the biennium, the governor is recommending $288 million of state aid and about $161 million of property tax. So about two-thirds of the increase would come from state aid and about one-third from local property tax levies. For the biennium as a whole, the state funding of the new dollars is about 71% and about 28% of that from property tax levies. As I understand it, there will be supplemental budget recommendations that will change these figures and will result in a higher state share versus the local share of the new dollars coming in. Table 2 is showing the trend in terms of the state share of state and local funding for K-12 education. Representative Heidgerton earlier had referred to the trend line here. As a result of the property tax reform in 2001, the state share was increased from 71% to about 86%. There has been a gradual decrease in the state share over the last few years as a result of primarily growth in school district referendum levies and bond issues, along with some loss of the equalization aid for referendum and debt service due to growing property values and declining enrollments. Under the governor's recommendation, you can see that in fiscal year 2006, the state share would increase slightly because the new money is coming in the form of aid. In fiscal year 2007, the state share would be reduced slightly because the 64% state share of the new dollars is below the current overall average of about 80%. So that tends to lower the state share slightly. So the state share would decline from 79.7% to 78.8%, or about 0.9%, under the governor's recommendation for 2007. Mm-hmm. That will need to be revisited after the supplemental budget recommendation. The table 3 on the next page is giving you the breakdown of the changes in property tax levies Under current law, between K05 and K06, and also under the governor's recommendations, school district property tax levies are projected to increase by about $158 million between this year and next year under current law, primarily as a result of new operating referendums being passed and new bond issues being passed. And the governor's recommendation would add about $152 million onto that, primarily as a result of the increase in the referendum cap, and the discretionary levy, along with the special ed inflation and the deferred maintenance recommendations of the governor. If you turn to the next page, page 3, you'll see a couple of examples of how the reverse referendum process would work for the three school district levies that are subject to reverse referendum, which would be the discretionary levy, the deferred maintenance levy, and the special education levy. And in the first example, we have a district that was receiving $220 or would be receiving $220 under the governor's proposal per pupil, $150 from the discretionary levy, $50 per pupil from the deferred maintenance, and $20 from the special education equalization. This is an equalized aid levy program. In my example, 86% of the money is coming from the property tax. The remainder is coming from state aid. So out of the $220,000, $191,000 would be property tax. That amount of property tax is compared against the property taxes that are being eliminated. And in my example, the district had a reemployment levy of $20,000, a safe schools levy, and a lost interest earnings levy, and a building lease levy, totaling $65 per student. So the way that the reverse referendum process would work, we would look at how much are they getting from the new levies. Take the three, add them together, you get $220 in this example. Subtract off what they were getting from the old levies that have been repealed. And for this particular district, they're seeing a $155 increase in their total levy per pupil as a result of the new levies coming in. We look at then, for purposes of the reverse referendum, how much of that exceeds the state average, which is a $76 per pupil increase. And in this particular district, it's a $79 per pupil increase that would be subject to reverse referendum. Of that $79, part of it is state aid and part of it is property tax. So in this particular district, $68 per student would be subject to a reverse referendum. That would amount to 1.1% of the district's net tax capacity. And if you turn the page, the next page shows what the notice might look like. This is a draft of the sort of notice that the school district would be required to publish in the newspaper to identify that they are proposing to increase their discretionary special education and deferred maintenance revenue by $79 per pupil that's subject to a reverse referendum, that this would require a tax rate of 1.1%, and then it would show what the dollar impact would be on various representative homes, agricultural properties, apartments, commercial industrial properties within the district. So this would be published in the newspaper in early October if the district had a total increase of more than $76 per pupil in these three levy categories. The next page is just another example that provides a similar calculation, but the difference here is that the school district in this case had an above average amount of levies under the old system. And this is just to show you how this process would work, where we're going to subtract off, again, in this case, the $220 per pupil minus the $125 the district was getting before. So they would be showing only a $19 increase that exceeded the $76 per pupil rate. And so in this case, what's happening is, because the district is getting less than a $76 per pupil increase in discretionary, the net difference is going to be netted off of the special education and deferred maintenance levies, and they're going to have a smaller amount that's subject to the reverse referendum process. So the goal here is just to give you a kind of a sample of how that process would play out for a district that had an above average amount of levies previously and for a district that had a below average amount of those levies previously. And Madam Chair,
Representative Dorn has a question.
Dr. Meltzer can finish, Madam Chair.
All right. I thought maybe it was right this moment. Okay. Go ahead.
This is actually a break between this and the next handout that I was going to.
Okay. This is a good time then.
Thank you. And Dr. Meltzer, I'm probably a few pages behind you again, but I was just looking at the draft notice. I just want to understand that the suggested was that they have proposed to increase the amount by $79 per pupil. Now, is that $79 per pupil greater than the $76 increase that they had also proposed?
Madam Chair and Representative Dorn, that's correct. The amount that would go on the notice here would be the amount that was subject to reverse referendum, which is only the increase exceeding the $76.
Okay. Madam Chair, just in thinking about it, I'm not sure how the draft should look, but I can imagine I would have some constituents who would say, why weren't we told that that was an increase on top of an increase? But if we start explaining the increase on top of the increase, I can imagine it could confuse people as in terms of how it all fit together. So, I think it's a draft, but I think it probably needs further thought, because they really would have proposed to increase it by 79 plus 76. So, and did you think about that? Maybe you can shed some light on why even the draft language reads this way.
Madam Chair and Representative Dorn, the reason that this draft language reads this way is that the $79 per pupil is the amount that would be subject to a reverse referendum. So if there was a petition filed, the amount that would be subject to not being authorized would be the $79. So you put the $79 on the ballot, it would be very similar to the way a ballot would look for an operating referendum if the district was asking for a $79 per pupil referendum. And school districts do have other levies that may go up or down, and we're treating the first $76 increase like that. There still would be the truth in taxation notices, which would provide the overall information to the taxpayers about what the overall impact was. And there could be, in the case of school finance, we have maybe 40 or 50 categories of different school levies, all of which could be going up or down. And this is just highlighting this one specific area and saying the new money above and beyond kind of the state average level of funding growth is going to be subject to a specific reverse referendum.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hyatt-Gurkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Meltzer. Just a little point. The education formula, as we all know, is very complex, and I think some of the mechanisms at work here suggested it actually adds more complexity to the situation, but it's just a general comment. But question, do you have any idea, or does Representative Chair Sikora have an idea when we're going to see the governor's supplemental budget?
As I understand, at 3 o'clock today.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Dr. Meltzer.
Madam Chair, I just was wondering, do we have just a couple more minutes time? I wasn't sure how long I should.
There's no other committee coming in because we have session at 3, so we can go just a few more minutes.
Okay, I just want to maybe explain what else you've got here, and we won't take the time to walk through all of the details. Maybe we should look at this computer run that's the landscape sideways sheet that are the estimates of the property tax impact of the governor's recommendations that the department has been able to model at this point. And what this report shows, the first several columns show the estimated market value for the school district and the current property tax levies that the school district makes. So about midway across the sheet, you can see the total levy the school district has and what the total levy is per $100,000 of market value. And the next section shows the total levy under the governor's recommendation and the levy per $100,000 of market value. And then the final two columns are showing the change. The change that's represented here is $105 million. The department has included in this modeling the discretionary levy, the special education levy, the deferred maintenance levy for those districts that have voter approval already for a referendum above the cap. It includes that. And it assumes that districts were levying 100% of the maximums for those categories. It does not include any sort of estimate for the QCOMP program because we don't know which districts would be participating in that. And it also doesn't include any estimate for which districts might get a new levy approved by the voters. So that's the reason why we have $105 million here, and the total the governor projects is $150. Overall, on average, this would result in an increase if the district chose to make all of those levies of $24 per year on a $100,000 house, or if you had a $200,000 house, it would be two times that amount. And you can see there is some variation among the school districts in terms of the impact on a per $100,000 of market value. And the final thing I just wanted to visit about briefly is this other document is a kind of a PowerPoint presentation that just walks through and explains some of the factors contributing to levy growth under current law and under the governor's recommendations. It has a little bit more information about the referendum cap and which districts are currently over the cap. I know you had a lot of discussion about that already in your committee meeting. And also, which districts would still be over the cap under the governor's recommendation. And just basically a little bit of background information on the different levies in the governor's proposal.
Thank you very much. Are there any further questions for Dr. Melcher? All right, hearing none, thank you so much, Dr. Melcher. I appreciate it. We may eventually have more questions on some of this stuff, but we know where to find you, unfortunately, for you. All right, looking at the minutes. Representative Meslow, would you like to move the minutes?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. I have no further business that's coming before the committee today. Next Tuesday, we will be hearing a lot of the fund transfer requests, so you know how those are. We have a lot of people want to transfer money between one of their funds and another that we don't normally allow. So we will be listening. I think almost all our committee time will be spent on those requests. So with that, we'll adjourn this meeting and see you next week.